Life's Third Act is a podcast dedicated to helping you get the most out of your retirement. Sponsored by Tucker Allen, here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another episode of Life's Third Act. We're continuing our series where we look for opportunities to learn from people who are famous or infamous about things we should or shouldn't do. Interestingly, even for people who have tremendous wealth, for example, or have, you know, complicated families that you know, we may not personally have all these characteristics, but it's funny how you can take these principles and there is an application for all of us in our more humble way, and especially in our more humble way for our subject this week. Marley, why don't you introduce our subject?
Yeah, so this week we're talking about Princess Diana, the people's princess.
The people's princess. Mm.
So I'm sure we're all very familiar with her.
We are, and I don't want, let me hurry to say, don't tune out because you think, oh, another Princess Diana, or I know all about her. You don't know about what we're going to talk about today. I mean, what we're talking about today is an aspect of her life that, interestingly, has gotten very little attention.
Yeah. Surprisingly, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, you did this research, and I was reading this last night and thinking, wow, I didn't know most of this stuff I didn't know.
Yeah.
So it's gotten very little publicity, so I think you're going to find this discussion interesting. So let's go back and kind of set us up with, she comes into the marriage, maybe a little bit with her background,
yeah,
and then into the early marriage.
Yeah, so born in 1961 in Norfolk, she became Lady Diana Spencer in 1975, but that was when her father inherited his earldom. And she married Charles, the Prince of Wales, in 1981, and that was at St. Paul's Cathedral. I don't remember, I wasn't alive then, but I've seen multiple videos, so we all remember the big, beautiful wedding dress, the big, beautiful ceremony.
Probably the wedding of that century, I'm trying to think about. You know, probably the wedding of the century.
Yeah, the royal weddings are a spectacle. They're beautiful, though. I love watching them. But she went on, you know, she took on various royal duties, and she had her sons William and Harry. And the couple separated in 1992, but they didn't actually officially divorce until 1996. And then she dropped her title, Your Royal Highness, but she kept Princess Diana. And she, you know, she was known for all kinds of things. She was known for being very charitable. She did a lot of work with HIV and AIDS. She did a lot of work with children. Just all kinds of things. She was amazing. She touched
a
lot of
lives.
Oh, yeah. And she kind of, she's really known for also bringing the royal family into, like, modernizing them almost and making sure that, not necessarily making sure that their names were out there, but just being a young face in that family and being, you know, somebody to look up to that other people could relate to. Because while she wasn't really a commoner, she still came from, you know, little bit less than
you'd normally see.
Yes.
So she was more accessible because her background, comparatively speaking, was a little more modest than you would typically see step into that role,
mm-hmm.
Marrying the Prince of Wales, which is in line for to become the king.
The king, yeah. And I mean, there's all sorts of things with their marriage and how all of that happened that doesn't look the greatest and all sorts of drama there. But really what we're focusing on today is after her unfortunate death in her car crash in 1997.
So when they marry in 81,
mm-hmm.
and they separate in 92. So she had a will prepared, which of course we're not surprised to know.
Yes. Yeah, she had a will prepared in 1993. And then as we were talking about, she had a codicil or an amendment to it in 1996, which would have been most likely after they got divorced.
So, and this is a case where there's no danger that somebody in this position is not going to have estate planning. I'll even jump to the conclusion that it wasn't even her idea,
mm-hmm.
but those around her had vested interest in assuring that things were handled in a proper way, except that the original will that she had done when the marriage was intact was probably not the will that she ultimately wanted, and that's the reason that there was later this change. Mm-hmm. And the change occurred after the divorce, the codicil.
Yes, that's correct. So there's speculation around the change.
Strong roots are essential for a healthy tree, especially your family tree. That's why you work hard to take care of your family every day. At Tucker Allen, we know that taking care of your family means planning for the future. Our team provides personalized estate planning to help you protect your family, your legacy, and your future. From wills and trusts to long-term care and estate planning, count on Tucker Allen, personalized estate planning made simple.
It was changed in February 1996, so a lot of people, you know, they didn't know if her mom and her sister got to her because they were the ones that she named as the executors in that change. So people thought maybe they got to her or that she was just taking Charles out or, you know, just any number of those things.
So we would expect to have a change in estate planning by somebody who's had a stable marriage, and that was one plan, and then the marriage fails or is failing, and then that's a new plan. So we would fully expect there to be a different plan. But I wonder to what extent she was following independent advice, because you know that the royal family had an opinion about what her estate plan should look like, but they didn't have any authority over her estate after the divorce.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think that's probably a big thing, is she just wanted them out of it. I mean, she in her life was just very unhappy to be there. She wanted out no matter what, because they didn't treat her the best. That's just kind of the moral of that story. And a lot of stuff was in the tabloids about her and that family. So I bet in just her mind, she just wanted to be done with them in that sense.
So her mother and her sister were named as executors of the will. And these are the people that are like trustees of a trust. And I think they actually ended up being trustees of the trust as well.
Mm-hmm.
So she had a provision where, not uncommonly, people will choose to create a trust in the will. So that means that somebody who's an executor, they don't have to be the people that are chosen to be the trustees of the trust, but typically they are. And so she had minor children. And she definitely wanted to create a trust in her will to assure that the money is handed over in the proper way at the proper time.
Yes. And I definitely think that she did that correctly. She knew, you know, I want my sons, no matter what, no matter where they go in life, to have something of mine and to be able to be supported, which now that we're here 30 years later and they have their trust, it's kind of turning out to be a good thing, since part of them have split off using that money and so on and so forth. But I definitely think she was just looking out for them in that sense.
Yeah. So talk about what the terms of the will were.
Yeah. So it was that both Harry and William would get their full trust when they turned 25. And she made it a discretionary fund so that it established that them and their family would be able to pool from those funds. So now that they're married to Meghan and Kate, those two, the wives, are also able to pool from those funds. And then also in her will, there was a provision of the letter of wishes. And do you want to speak on this, or do you want me to?
Well, talk about it the way that it's been reported, and then I'll give a little bit of the legal implications.
Yeah. So in the letter of wishes, she basically said that she wanted 3/4 and her jewelry of, you know, 3/4 of her personal property and her jewelry to go to her sons. She stated that she would like to, you know, in the future see their wives wearing that jewelry, and they did. They have it now and still. And then it stated that 1/4 she wanted to go to her 17 godchildren. And kind of as we were discussing, her godchildren were very important to her. She treated them like they were her own personal children. She, you know, wrote them birthday cards every year. She visited them all the time. And kind of, you know, in the Church of England, there's that christening, and she took on those promises that they have to promise whenever all of that happens of a godparent.
So being a godmother or godfather is a significant undertaking.
Yes, it's huge. So they have to go up in front of everybody in the church and take promises under an oath of God, and they have to promise to you know, teach this child about Jesus and God and the church, and they have to promise to take care of them and teach them life lessons. So it's basically like you're becoming a parent all over again.
And she, and I think royalty probably take this role more seriously, maybe than a commoner or the average people. So it is kind of, it's not so much a legal obligation, it's a moral and social obligation. And you see it among the aristocracy and especially peerage in the UK. So she took her role seriously. Mm-hmm. She was active in these, you know, she remembered birthdays and holidays and everything for all these 17 kids.
I mean, she loved them. Like I said, like they were her own, and she never missed a birthday, never missed a holiday. She knew all of them, and that's a lot of kids to keep track of. But they're all doing good. They've all, you know, moved on to their lives, grown into great people. So even while she was around, even if it was for a short amount of time, I definitely think that she had an impact on them.
Yeah. So she cared enough to where she put a provision mm-hmm. in her, well, in this letter of wishes. That, and we'll talk, let me talk a little bit about the way that's viewed by the law is, it's much better if you want something to be enforced that it be incorporated into the will. And when you have a document that, like, and it's not unusual to have something, in the U.S. it's called a precatory language. P-R-E-C, precatory language. It means that you are expressing a desire, a wish, a hope. Sometimes precatory language can arise to a command or a direction, depending on how it's worded. There are sometimes litigation over whether language that actually was in a will or a trust was precatory, because somebody may say, it's my desire, I'm leaving you this $10 million. And it's my desire that you will take care of the children, that you will assure their needs are met. You can see, well, how do you interpret that? Is it, do we say that that is a preference, or do we say that that's an instruction? So that's how precatory language can go either way, and unfortunately results in litigation that can be avoided by not using precatory language unless you truly do intend it to be a suggestion. Now, in this case, it had to be viewed as a suggestion because it wasn't incorporated in the will. And had this document existed first, there could have been what's called an incorporation by reference. So this letter, had it existed already, then the will were prepared, then there could have been language in the will that made reference to that. And that has the sanctity of the will itself. But there still needs to be clear direction. But the title of this letter of wishes, I think that's a UK thing. So you have to believe that somebody told her, or you hope somebody told her, that this is not a sure way for you to know that the things you want will be done. But she may have naively thought that, look, I don't need to change my will again on these particular things. I think I can just go ahead and make these, you know, tell people what I'd like to see happen, and they're going to do it. Maybe she naively thought that. And let's face it, it could have happened that way. But usually when money's at stake and you go into probate, and remember, a will always, always, always means probate. It means, particularly when you have this much money at stake, then it means that there's not going to be much quarter shown. Meaning that you know you can't expect somebody to voluntarily give up money, so it ends up being whatever's in ink on the page and clear with a command as opposed to suggestion. That's what's going to win. And in this case, kind of what happened is this letter was pushed aside. And that was produced a lot of resentment.
Yes. So what happened was her mother and her sister requested a variance of the will in probate court, and they called it the arrangement. And basically what they did was they changed that William and Harry wouldn't get their trust at 25. They would only get the interest that the trust had earned at 25, and they would get the full amount of the trust at 30. But the other big thing was that they basically changed the letter of wishes to mean, or well, to say,
interpreted.
Yes, to say that the godchildren only got what they called one small trinket. So they really didn't get anything. And Diana's personal property, I mean, it included her wedding dress, 28 like other dresses, tiaras, the jewelry, books, paintings, family movies, all kinds of things.
So, and let's talk a little more about what the content was. There was a lot of times when you, when you're doing probate, or you're if you sit in a probate court and listen, often the real action, the real dispute, the things of value tend to be assets such as financial assets. They can be stocks, bonds, real estate. I mean, those sorts of assets are the things that are substantial for the vast majority of people. It's not personal property. It's not stuff, you know, a collection you have. I mean, a collection could be worth, you know, it's not unusual for a baseball card collection to be worth $10,000 or $5,000. But usually that's not the centerpiece of attention in probate, mm-hmm. because those things almost always are relatively small percentage of the estate. In this case, well, everything was worth a significant amount. Yeah. There was money. How much, what was the value of the...
So the value of her estate when she died was 21 million pounds, which is, it would have equivalented to around 31.5 million U.S. dollars. So
we'll try to use dollars here.
Yes.
yeah. So we'll call it 32 million. Now, remember, yes. This is, you know, 30 years ago. So this is, it's a lot of money.
Yeah. And I mean, that included like all of her stocks, all of her funds. It was the divorce settlement, the jewelry, all.
But I don't think, wait now, I understood that mm-hmm. to not include the value of like her wedding dress and the diamonds and all. Do you?
I think it included the value of her wedding dress and the value of her jewelry. It didn't include the value of all of the other remainder. That's why she made sure that her sons got the jewelry instead.
Okay, mm-hmm. So we have this, we have cash, and the cash, we'll say, is probably north of 20 million. But we also have, you know, these, I don't know how many tiaras there are. There was this wedding dress alone must be priceless.
Oh, yeah.
It's had 10,000 pearls.
Mm-hmm. It was crazy.
I can't imagine.
25-foot train.
So,
yeah.
and then in the tiaras, it's not just the diamonds. It's really, matter of fact, that's probably less than half the value of it. It's really who owned it, and that's its value. And so these personality items, sometimes the court called them chattel, C-H-A-T-T-E-L. It just means personality. It means you have real estate and you have chattel, real property and chattel. So all these things are called chattel. But I mean, there's just lots of things here that would have a great deal of fair market value. This isn't just memoirs that have personal value. They do have personal value to the family, but far more than that. All these things have great market value. So I can't imagine what these numbers would be today if they were updated.
Crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. So what the court ultimately did, and this was with the executors who, remember, kind of, they represent the estate, so they file motions in probate, and generally they're going to get what they want as long as it's not inconsistent with the will, mm-hmm. and unless somebody files an objection. And there's lots of room for objections in probate. That's a reason we've all heard about these multi-year, multi-million dollar litigation that's gone on in probate. It's because people show up and say, well, wait, I don't think that they should have that. I think I should have that. Or I don't think that will is correct. Or I think that there was undue influence. I think there was fraud. I mean, there are so many allegations that can be made and often are. In this case, we didn't have that ugliness in the court. I mean, I think the royal family was determined, as well as the court, mm-hmm. was determined to keep this dignified. So I think that pretty much what the executors asked for, as long as it wasn't inconsistent with the will, I think they got. And so this one thing they wanted, they asked the court to do is you know, they persuaded the court that Diane would have had this age extended from 25 to 30. Mm-hmm. So the court thought, yeah, that's consistent, probably consistent with the interest or the desires of the decedent. And also they chose to make what I think they regarded as a charitable gesture. I think they felt that they didn't actually have to do anything for these 17 godkids because this reference was made in the letter. So these godchildren, I think that it was supposed to look, I don't think they intended it to look mean-spirited. I think that they thought this would look kind or charitable. Mm-hmm. And from their perspective, they thought, let's go ahead and let them pick certain things of her personal property, not the tiaras.
Not the wedding dress.
Yeah, not the high-end stuff. But some of the parents, when they heard about this later, which they didn't hear for a while.
Yeah, so they actually kind of kept it under wraps. Like, there's a lot of speculation to all of this. Part of it is, and we'll get into this, but they took the rest of the items that they didn't give to the God Kids and they put it, you know, up for display, basically, and earned money off of it. And so a lot of speculation is her family didn't get any money. It was only the boys that got anything. So they were probably thinking, oh, well, we want our piece. But yeah, they, since it wasn't technically part of the will, they kept it quiet. And the parents of the godchildren only learned about it through like other legal litigation. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they were really upset whenever they figured it out. But I think at that point, and you can speak on this, but I don't really think they could do anything more, could
no.
they? Yeah.
No, and it's because you have this letter of wishes. Mm-hmm. And had this been in the will, of course it's enforceable. So another aspect of it not being in the will is it's not public. So the probate court is a very public place. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason we know very personal things about anybody who's had litigation in probate court. It goes with the territory. It's the reason we know what we know about Diane's estate. So the parents of these godchildren did not know until, I think it was just inadvertent or accidental. Mm-hmm. They didn't have to find out, yeah. But somehow they did.
I think it was completely accidental. I mean, the tabloids are always all over the royal family.
Well, so that's probably the explanation.
Yeah.
So it comes out a few years later, and there was a lot of resentment about it, and I can understand that. I based on what you've said about Diane and the role that these, you know, when she decided for each of these kids that she would agree to be a godmother, I think she felt this moral obligation to do something significant for them. So then I'll talk a little bit about some of these, I won't call them state treasures, but they are things that have a great deal of value to the British Empire. So the Dominion countries, as well as the UK, we're not talking about just the UK, we're talking about Australia, Canada. I mean, these countries all had great pride in Diana, despite the way there was a divorce and all that. So the wedding dress, you know, some of the jewelry, a lot of the personal things that could have just been sold if this were just about money, they weren't. And one of the Spencer family, and it was who?
Earl Spencer, her brother.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Diana's brother, who owned a gorgeous estate. They
yes.
all owned estates. And this sounds like a pretty fair thing to do. It would continue to be owned. Incidentally, the two children end up being the beneficiaries of everything, ultimately. But this, for a number of years, and I don't know if they're still doing it, it was open, the estate was open so people could come and view it.
Yes.
And they paid a fee, and the fee, I think, went to charity, did it not?
This fee didn't. So for 2 months out of the year, people could come to Althorp and view all of her collection. That went to the family. What they did for
that fee.
Yes.
Okay.
And what they did for the remainder of the year was they donated the items to museums. So any sales, like ticket sales from those items, went to charity.
Okay. All right. So
it was 50-50.
It could have been worse.
Immoral.
It could have been worse.
Yeah.
So for 2 months a year, it's generating, I shudder to think how much it made.
But, especially in England, just alone, a lot.
Right, right. So 2 months a year, people would make appointments, stand in line, and get a chance to view all these things, these personal things of Lady Di. And I'm sure that generated a substantial amount of money for that 2 months. And then the rest was charitable, the other 10 months out of the year. So just some comments here. I think that the estate planning could have been significantly better. There was, they have an inheritance tax that's brutal in the UK. And what was originally north of $30 million, the inheritance tax on that brought it down to, it wasn't quite 50%. It was 43%. So just think about how much of that was wiped off the top. Now, these assets gained in value, so we don't know their numbers today, but we can be sure that there's a lot more today than there was. But one criticism I would have is that there could have been tax planning done. I'll jump to that conclusion, though it's the UK. I'll jump to the conclusion that you could have done tax planning. But the thought occurs to me that the royal family is so self-conscious about their wealth, mm-hmm. and about they walk on eggshells with, you know, the people of England, because all they have to do is decide they don't want a monarchy anymore, and it's gone. And their assets, arguably, they own, but who knows, you know, with Parliament and their unique situation. So I think that the royal family is much more attentive to their public image in the modern world than they were with Henry VIII. if somebody complained, you execute them. So they may not want to take advantage of all these tax loopholes, mm-hmm. and whatnot. They may not be inclined to create tax shelters. They may figure that that's going to end up in the new, and it would end up. I mean, when if there had been, you know, whatever taxes were paid here, I guarantee it was printed. Mm-hmm. It was printed in all the tabloids. So if it had turned out there were no taxes paid, then I think that maybe they voluntarily do not do tax planning. I'm just speculating.
Yeah, I mean, that would make sense. They're always plagued by the media and the tabloids. So that was probably just a thing that, oh, there's going to be enough money after taxes that it'll be fine anyway.
Yeah.
So they probably just didn't want to look like they were committing tax fraud
or something
like that, because who knows what the tabloids would have turned that into.
And there are people who think that, and especially of a royal family, mm-hmm. but think that the rich really should pay taxes, voluntarily pay taxes, even though that there are ways they could avoid it. Mm-hmm. And the royal family, I think that'd be true times 10. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's speculation. Another thing is that a trust that had been created while everyone was alive, or at least while Diane was alive, would have put everything beyond the reach of the public. I mean, a trust, one of its beautiful things about it is that you create something that's in place when Diane's alive, and this they call the settlor. And the wonderful thing about that is then it would have been operating already according to the rules that Diane had created. As I've said before, it's not that when you create a trust, it's impossible for somebody to challenge it when you die, presumably years later, in this case, a year later. But it is harder because it's been in place and it's had the clear approval of the settlor. And more likely that people understand its terms. They don't have to, but more likely that the beneficiaries will have been told what the terms are. Usually that makes sense, not always. But in this case, whether this was precatory or not, probably would have been resolved with a trust rather than a will. And I think in this case that the provision that the trust was created in the will just meant that it had to go through probate in order to get where it would already have been before.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever those costs of probate would be gone, because the money the assets would already be sitting in the trust. So when she passes away, then the trust just makes a notation that, okay, now we shift to, you know, the rules when the settlor dies, and it's just business as usual for a trustee. So you may have a change of trustee, but the point is it's not anything like probate, and you don't have the attorney fees and whatnot associated with that. So that was a lot of delay, and ultimately information came out that created a lot of hard feelings with these other, I'm sure, peerage families.
And I think that, you know, had they gone to the parents of the godchildren, and I mean, like, they might have had good intentions of just keeping her stuff in the family. You want to keep somebody's history. So I feel like if they would have just gone to the godparents and been like, hey, your children can have these things, but we want to make sure that we keep this, they would have been fine with that. But I think just because they kept it secret, there's all these conspiracies surrounding it, and, you know, because they're pocketing some of the money, everyone's like, well, what are you actually up to?
Yeah. So. Yeah, yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of distrust by these parents, and they do feel like their children were hoodwinked.
Yes, yeah. And I mean, also, the godchildren were people that she, you know, had met through the royal family or had already been, you know, distant cousins or stuff like that. But a majority of them were people that she met through marriage. And so maybe even her family just wanted to keep it away from those people because she was treated so badly by the royal family.
Yeah. And you're right. And furthermore, she lost, you know, these children lost this godparent that is important in that world in the UK, and especially in the royalty or the peerage, I'll say peerage world, aristocracy. An example of this is I was reading a biography not long ago of Winston Churchill. I'm a huge fan of Winston Churchill. Maybe we'll talk about his estate planning sometime. But I don't remember the name of his godfather, but there was a godfather. And now I remember Winston Churchill grew up, you know, Marlborough, the Marlborough estate. I mean, this is one of the Duke of Marlborough is one of the huge historical figures in English history. And that was his great, great grandfather. And he wrote a book about his life, 4 volumes, actually. So but here he is. He's born into aristocracy, a prominent family. And one of the members of the aristocracy, this person agreed to be his godfather. Mm-hmm. And this relationship was very important to Churchill's career. There were points when, at low points, when he was threatening to be thrown out of the Parliament. He was in the House of Commons, and he had changed political parties. But the point is, he was not very popular at all. There were several periods in his life, believe it or not, and now he's an icon. But there were periods in his life, early in his life especially, he was very unpopular. And his political future was at stake. And he called on his godfather, who had connections. And his godfather went to bat for him and managed to avert what would have robbed him of his position in the cabinet. So I think that this relationship is important among this class of people.
Yes.
And it may filter down to the commoners as well in the UK. I should ask somebody who would know that. But anyway, so I think that one thing, getting to another thing that I would love to have seen changed is to suggest to Lady Di, that maybe 25 or even 30 is maybe a little too soon. We'll know soon with Harry. I mean, Harry has gotten his money at this stage.
Yeah.
So we know that because he's over 30 and he's close to 40.
Yeah, both of them have gotten the money. So just a little bit of royal family lore is whenever Meghan and Harry split from the family, that's how they did it, is because he had come into his trust. So they were able to move away. They were no longer relying on them for
money. How old
money.
Was he when he did that? Do you have any idea how old he is?
I don't know.
Can you look up, Justin, how old is Harry now?
They've got to be late 30s, I believe, because that was a couple years ago.
39.
Yep. So you just wonder, I mean, did he make wise decisions, though, with that money before he left with his wife and chose to live in the U.S.? And I just wonder if... Many people are not equipped, even at age 30, to make the right decisions. And those of you who watch this show, you know that I'm a big advocate with clients and others that if you have a significant estate at all, and I'm not talking about rich, I'm talking about $300,000-$400,000 or so or less, it probably is not a good idea to simply put in your estate planning, in your trust even, that you want it to be handed out, dispensed at a particular age. Mm-hmm. Why not instead keep it in a place where it's safe and it's protected from litigation, it's protected from divorce?
Mm-hmm.
Not that Harry's headed in that way, but who knows?
Yeah.
I mean, who knows? He's given up so much for this woman.
Yeah, all kinds of stuff. And I mean, I would say rightfully so. Some people might not, but that's a story for another day.
No, that's a fair point.
But I mean, the wives can also draw from it. So I wonder, like, I don't think either of their marriages are horrible or headed for divorce or anything, but I kind of wonder, just in general circumstances, if that would also stop, you know, the divorce and so on and so forth.
Yeah, there was a provision that I don't think we mentioned, is that there was, I think it was $1.5 million.
Mm-hmm.
There was one article that said 100,000, but I think that the language was 1.5 million that was available for the needs of the boys before age 30.
Yes.
And that also, a part of that was available for the 17 godchildren. Were they included in that?
I don't believe they were included in it. I think it was only her possessions.
Okay. So anyway, the point is that this money came into the hands of both the boys, and they may very well manage it well, but it could be gone. And there's just no reason. You can still have it available and have all these protections.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there may never be a divorce with Harry, but, you know, it's a difficult situation. And I think it would be tough for him to hang on to that money, depending on her assets, if he's taken it and placed it in a joint account. So that's a sort of innocent mistake that somebody, a young man in his 30s, can easily make that mistake, or 40s or 50s. So, you know, it's better to keep it in the trust and let the trustee have liberal permission to give him the money when he needs it for a particular thing. So it could be generously, you know, liberally available. And at the same time, the corpus is protected. And in this case, again, if there is a divorce, all these assets will be on the table.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there was a prenup. I didn't hear anything about a prenup.
I've never heard anything. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. It would be smart, but
I don't know that Harry's smart like that.
Yeah.
I mean, he was pretty starry-eyed. And I think that Meghan, what's her name? Meghan Markle?
Mm-hmm, Meghan Markle.
I think that Meghan, I mean, she would have reason to oppose such a thing.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Yeah.
And she would have a lot of influence, more influence than I think his lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some lessons here. By talking about this, you understand, I guess, a lot more about royalty, but and that's good. But even better is, you know, do you get a feel of some things that are important for your estate planning and the way you do that? I think that, thankfully, there was a will.
Mm-hmm.
But Lady Di had an infrastructure that assured that things like that weren't overlooked. Now, despite my complaints that it could have been a better estate plan, still, she had an infrastructure that assured that things like that, you know, didn't get overlooked.
Yeah.
The rest of us don't have that. So, you know, there's no one that's going to make an appointment for you or have the lawyers to come arrive to your home to do your estate planning for you. You know, this is something that we all have to take the initiative to do. And too often it's not done.
Yeah. And I definitely think somebody should have guided her better on not including the letter of wishes and just putting it in the will instead. Or, like you said, putting it in a trust so then there was rules to follow.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll never know that backstory.
Yeah.
But that is a shame. But anyway, I hope you found this beneficial and helpful. Thank you, Marley, for your contributions, your expertise on this subject, the royal family. So maybe we will do Churchill sometime.
Yeah, I will definitely look into that. And I mean, if any of our viewers have suggestions, drop them in the comments. I would love to hear from them.
So. Okay. Yeah. Give us suggestions. That's right. It's very important that we want to look for people's lives and estate planning that are of interest to you and also that have a learning opportunity. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, give us your thoughts. Press the like button, subscribe. This has been another episode of Life's Third Act. Till next time, take care.
You've been listening to Life's Third Act, a podcast for thriving in retirement. Sponsored by Tucker Allen, your estate and elder law advisors. Each week, we discuss topics and answer questions to help you better plan for your future. For more information, visit TuckerAllen.com. Subscribe and listen again next week for another edition of Life's Third Act. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.
That are of interest to you and also that have a learning opportunity. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, give us your thoughts. Press the like button, subscribe. This has been another episode of Life's Third Act. Till next time, take care.
You've been listening to Life's Third Act, a podcast for thriving in retirement. Sponsored by Tucker Allen, your estate and elder law advisors. Each week, we discuss topics and answer questions to help you better plan for your future. For more information, visit TuckerAllen.com. Subscribe and listen again next week for another edition of Life's Third Act. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.